Reporting. You mentioned that Australia has a trade surplus. That certainly must encourage, to some extent at least, positive ideas about the relationship, at least the trade relationship between Australia and China, because Australians are benefiting enormously from Chinese imports, right?
Australia's economic well-being has been very much tied to the economic development of China over the last 15 years. So Australian food products, commodities like barley, as well as wine, of course, and beef and seafood, all began to feature on the dining tables of Chinese households, whether that was at home.
I mean, another thing I like to think about is the fact that if you're a developing nation and you install solar, great. You have this solar system for 30 or 40 years before it needs to be like partially replaced. You don't need to import fuel to make that system work because fuel comes straight out of the sky. So, I mean, that's also creates more energy independence.
Welcome to The Bridge, fun conversations on culture, life, and everything in between.
Find us where you get your podcasts. If you like the show, then consider pushing the like button or giving us 5 stars. Suggestions, comments, anything you would like to share, email us at welovethebridge@gmail.com. We love The Bridge.
Welcome to The Bridge. Today we have a special guest. Professor Warwick Powell was former advisor to the Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, former advisor to the Minister for Mines and Energy, chairman and founder of Smart Trade Networks, adjunct professor at Queensland University of Technology, James Cook University, and Edith Cowan University. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And a senior fellow at the Taiha Institute. And he is a frequent media commentator on numerous platforms, including CGTN. Welcome back to the program, Professor Powell.
Great to be with you.
I was going to ask you a question at the end, but I was talking with someone we know in common, a professor in Shanghai, and he said to ask you about your children learning Chinese in Australia. So I'm going to start with that.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit of a challenge, but the children attend Chinese classes every Saturday, and that goes for 3 hours. Mm. The classes are run actually by a local Buddhist temple, and they run Chinese lessons for children in the city, and quite a lot of children attend, children of Chinese backgrounds and children of mixed backgrounds, and it's quite a dynamic little environment.
So why are they learning Chinese?
Because they're three quarters Chinese is the short answer.
I assumed it was for economic reasons.
No. Well, who knows what happens, right, in terms of the future, but it's a way that it's so that they can communicate with their grandparents and with their cousins. And I also mainly speak Chinese Mandarin at home as well. So it's a way to try to get them to speak Chinese at home, though not with much success. There's a bit of resistance. So often we'll speak Chinese to them and they'll answer in English.
Wow. Well, okay. You know, that's probably better than me. I speak mostly English at home, even though I've been taking Chinese for years and years and years and years. But I wanted to talk about Chinese economy. And so China's economy grew by 5.2% in 2023, and the U.S. grew by 2.5%, I think. So there's a lot of talk in U.S. media specifically that China's economy is slowing down and so forth. So you're an economist. How would you characterize China's economy in 2023 and moving into 2024?
Well, China's economy in 2023 showed significant resilience coming back as it did from the very challenging period of 2022 as a result of the management of COVID. The fact of the matter is that the Chinese economy as a whole exhibited a whole range of strengths in terms of how it responded to the pandemic, number one, and then subsequently how different parts of the economy really began to pick up steam as 2023 went on. Obviously, the shape of the economy and the things that the economy is focusing on now is different to the things that drove the Chinese economic development experience during the course of the previous decade or so. But there is no doubt that the capabilities of the Chinese economic structure to adapt to circumstances and to continually innovate and transform itself, particularly down the pathway of new technologies, modernization, increased productivity, green investments and those sorts of things. I mean, it's a remarkably resilient and dynamic animal, so to speak.
You know, I did notice as someone who follows green energy that not only did China install as much solar in 2023 as the entire world in 2022, but as someone who's not an economist, I noticed there were quite a few articles saying that green energy gave China's economy a dramatic push in 2023. How do you see the role of advanced technology, especially solar and wind and other renewable energies, as contributing to Chinese economic growth?
Well, it's going to play a big part. Firstly, it plays an important part in terms of the capital investments that are being made to install and construct green energy related projects and integrate those projects into the electricity grid or into specific projects. We're also seeing green energy or renewable energy feed its way through the entire system, if you will, right through to transportation solutions with electric vehicles, public transport and the like. So it's going to play a very important role, you know, in both of those regards. Firstly, in terms of the actual construction activity itself and the manufacturing of the equipment. And the second thing is that it will actually deliver low-cost renewable energy for industries going forward, as well as for households, which means clean and affordable energy. The last dimension of all of that is that these technologies and know-how in terms of the management of these technologies and how to install these systems and how to optimize them in terms of specific conditions is only going to add to China's capabilities in terms of the export markets as well.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask you a lot about that, about Australia's relationship with China right now in context of EVs and green energy. Australia and China are members, as are dozens of countries, I believe. What is the shape of Sino-Australian relations within the context of being members of both the RCEP and Baoform? Shouldn't economic relations between China and Australia be relatively strong given all of the organizations that they're both members of?
Australia and China has and continues to enjoy strong trading relationships and, to varying extents over the last 20 years, investment relationships. In terms of trade, which is the big marker for a lot of people, Australia enjoys a trade surplus with China through its exports of natural resources and foods and those sorts of things in particular. And the volume and value of trade between Australia and China actually reached record levels in 2023. Now, if the Chinese economy was going down the gurgler or was on the edge of crisis and collapse, you do wonder why it would continue to be such a massive customer of Australian products. So the relationship economically remains very, very robust, notwithstanding some notable hiccups along the way. But, you know, hiccups are to be expected in relationships between countries. You know, the world isn't a perfect place. And from time to time, people and countries will have differences of opinion that need to be worked through.
As I understand the RCEP, Regional Cooperative...
Regional Comprehensive
Economic Partnership is the largest trade bloc in the world. Is that correct?
It is certainly the largest free trade agreement in the world in terms of the value of the goods and services that it covers. And it involves also 15 nations. So it's a very significant multilateral trading arrangement. The participants are the 10 member states of ASEAN, as well as China, Japan, Republic of Korea, New Zealand, and Australia. Of all of those 15 member nations, China's economy contributes 54% of the total GDP, followed by Japan with 19%, then Australia and Republic of Korea both at 6%. So, China's a big piece of the jigsaw puzzle, and you can see that in the growing trade relationships between China and all of the other member states of participating in the RCEP.
You know, most of the time when people think of China, people think of an export partner that China is exporting. You mentioned that Australia has a trade surplus. That certainly must encourage, to some extent at least, positive ideas about the relationship, at least the trade relationship between Australia and China, because Australians are benefiting enormously from Chinese imports, right?
Australia's economic well-being has been very much tied to the economic development of China over the last 15 years. The urbanization drive that underpinned much of China's economic development during the course of the 2010s led to significant demand for Australian natural resources, particularly in iron ore and coal. But it also transformed the demand profile for a whole range of other goods as people urbanised. So Australian food products, commodities like barley, as well as wine, of course, and beef and seafood, all began to feature on the dining tables of Chinese households, whether that was at home or in restaurants. So the progressive growth in household incomes in China over the course of the 2010s was actually a direct contributor to Australian economic well-being. And that has engendered, I think, a desire amongst the business community, as well as people in the political apparatus or the machinery of government that is actually focused on economic development, to realise that the trade relationship is of vital importance to ongoing wealth creation for Australians.
Well, I think in China, I've had an uneven hand in consuming a lot of Australian wine. So I think I've participated in Australian economic growth myself.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. In terms, I mean, it's readily available, high quality, and it's affordable wine. So, I mean, why not? So in terms of key sectors driving economic growth, you mentioned EVs. It's really interesting because the world is having to understand China's new auto export market. In Europe, certainly there's an enormous amount of BYDs being sold, and the United States is not, to my understanding, importing a lot of Chinese EVs, although they are in terms of mass transit vehicles like buses. So what's the relationship with Australia? Is Australia allowing Chinese EVs?
Yeah, Australia is allowing Chinese EVs. Look, Australia has not had a domestic automobile manufacturing sector for a number of years now, since the end of the subsidies about 10 years or so ago. So Australia fully imports all of its passenger motor vehicles. And in transforming the economic model in Australia over the last 30 years, we have seen the progressive eradication of tariffs on manufacturers, including motor vehicles. And the benefit for Australian households and many enterprises is access to much lower cost products, and in this case, it's motor vehicles. So these days, you can go to dealerships to buy Chinese motor vehicles, particularly those that are based on diesel or petrol or gasoline. But increasingly, we're starting to see electric vehicles such as BYD make their mark. And if you go to a shopping mall these days, you'll often find a couple of BYDs on display, with people handing out brochures and taking inquiries and those sorts of things. So there is a growing interest in electric vehicles, generally speaking, and certainly the Chinese EVs are both cutting edge from a technology point of view, but tremendously priced. You've got to remember that prior to the Chinese EVs emerging on the landscape over the last 3 to 4 years, the consumer market for EVs was basically the Tesla market. And so the Tesla market was always pitched at the much higher end, the upper middle and higher end marketplace, price point wise. And the Chinese product range really goes up and down the entire price range, making EVs now accessible and affordable to a lot more people. Oh, yeah.
You're listening to The Bridge.
I'm from California, and we've been talking about the Green Revolution since the 80s, at least, when I was a very young boy. And we still haven't really rolled out EVs in mass in the way that China has. One thing that I've noticed is that before EVs really caught on in China, which they're incredibly hot now, China rolled out the charging infrastructure across the entire nation to make it viable to do so, to buy an EV. And even in California in 2024, we're still debating with the issue of how do we roll out enough charging stations to encourage consumers to buy EVs. Australia is much less populated than California, even. Do you think that the charging infrastructure will just have to come at the same time as EVs are selling? Or is Australia able to take steps that maybe California hasn't in rolling out a better charging infrastructure?
Well, charging infrastructure is being rolled out in Australia, and it's certainly sufficient to warrant people purchasing Teslas. And I think we're going to start to see a more prolific implementation of charging stations across the country. I remember about 10 or so years ago, there were attempts by an Australian company to bring at that stage Israeli technology into Australia to roll out the first generation of charging stations. And in the end, that didn't get anywhere. It was just a little bit too early. But with Tesla's original success, together with these seriously competitively priced models coming from the Chinese factories, we are going to see, I think, a combination of people buying the EVs, but also the infrastructure being rolled out. Now, the manufacturers themselves, of course, are playing a great role in rolling out the infrastructure, and we're going to start to see that continue. The next big transition, I think, is going to be in the commercial space, where EV charging stations, particularly with super fast charging capabilities, will need to be implemented in the long haul routes between the major cities in Australia that are currently serviced by the big trucks. Mm.
You know, I find it interesting. I was looking at a moving graph over time recently in terms of how many exports come from China to the EU, to the United States, and also to the developing world. And it looks like while China's doing well at exporting to the United States and the EU, that is taking up a smaller and smaller percentage of total Chinese exports. A lot of exports are going to the developing world. China has both BRICS, but also the Belt and Road Initiative, which is developing markets around the world. And it looks like increasingly these countries are importing Chinese goods. Do you think China's long-term plan to develop better trade and markets with the underdeveloped world is bearing fruit and creating stability?
It's certainly bearing fruit, and that's a very different economic model and an economic outcome to globalization than has been experienced by and large over the course of the last 300 to 400 or 500 years. Most of these countries that you talk about, I guess we loosely describe them as belonging to the global south or the developing world space, as opposed to what used to be called the first world and the developed world, or, you know, the G7 perhaps. And for many, many decades, mm-hmm. the institutions of economic governance and management globally has largely seen these countries at the so-called peripheries of the global economic system play the role of supplier of raw materials and cheap labor, so that the economies at the center of the system, basically those of North America and Western Europe, are able to benefit through extracting value. That model's changing, and it's changing in very important ways. It's changing because there is a commitment to investing in the hard infrastructure that's necessary for economic development to even happen. And that hard infrastructure is all about enabling the flow of resources, whether they're people or commodities and products, as well as the flow of ideas and information. So we're talking about the digital infrastructure that enables data to flow, as well as the physical infrastructure like railroads, roads, ports, airports, and things like that, that enables physical goods and people to move from point A to point B. Once you've built that infrastructure and you've got that in place, together with the energy infrastructure that you need, and that touches on the renewable stuff that we talked about earlier, we're starting to have an environment where new businesses can develop and grow, and expanded capital accumulation can start to take place locally. And when that happens, it kicks off new cycles of economic development, which employs people, adds new skills, increases wages, which then drives further demand for new products. Now, what you've seen over the last 15 years, Jason, is firstly a commitment to supporting the development of infrastructure, number one. That lays the foundations. Secondly, now, we're starting to see the development of enterprises and skilling of people, and that's going to grow household incomes. And that, in and of itself, leads to a couple of things. One is demand for products from China. But eventually, it also leads to investments being made, often by Chinese firms, in these countries to manufacture locally as the cost economies, I guess, start to change, where those things that used to be made or are still made in China are actually more cost effectively made in the developing world. So China's approach to this is much less about the center taking from the periphery and maintaining that as a status quo, and much more about activating cycles of economic development where each cycle lays a new foundation or a new stepping stone for the next cycle, whether it's in infrastructure, whether it's in skills, whether it's in know-how. And these circuits is what's starting to generate the new demand in the developing world for things that China currently manufactures. And that is changing the contours of global economic commerce and value flow.
You know, there's a couple of different questions that what you said bring to light to me. One thing that I've noted, and I spoke about this with many economists, is that, you know, bringing renewable energy, hydropower dams, even other forms of energy, you know, fossil fuel emitting energy, what that facilitates is the ability to build local infrastructure. I mean, obviously, it brings things like refrigeration and telecommunications. Everyone knows Huawei helped the underdeveloped world considerably by rolling out 5G in a way that no other telecommunications company has been able to achieve. And so those bring with them, you know, obviously just access to knowledge, because people can have a cell phone with knowledge on it and refrigerate their goods. And so it brings convenience, but it also brings, like you mentioned, the ability to build local industry. So the need for electrification in the underdeveloped world is now being met to some extent by the Belt and Road, by other investors around the world as well. But what you really touched on is something that I am very curious about. And I know that you are an expert in it to some extent. I've even heard this term or read this term. What is it? The digital Silk Road. So now that we've built a lot of the infrastructure, the ports, the roads, the bridges, the rail, the energy infrastructure, and now increasingly industry too, a lot of the Belt and Road seems to be pivoting to another kind of Silk Road, not a maritime Silk Road, not a land-based Silk Road, but a digital Silk Road. Could you expand on what a digital Silk Road is?
A part of economic development that's often poorly understood or not at the forefront of people's mind is the role that information plays in the economic system. It's something that we take for granted in many ways because we live in an information environment where we communicate information and pass it on to other people. And we do that so that others can do something else, right, in response to the information that they've received. So information plays a foundational role in the way that businesses or enterprises can make things. Right? Without information about systems, about production processes, about chemical processes, it's actually impossible for organizations to take a bunch of different inputs and transform them through the application of machines and technology and labor to create new things. So information really sits at the heart of how we produce things. But information also sits at the heart of how we exchange things, because when people produce lots of things, they also need to exchange those things with others. No individual and no individual enterprise is a self-sufficient island. And that's why we have divisions of labor. And that's why we have exchange relationships, so that everybody's needs can be fulfilled through time. Now, when we do that, information is actually one of the most important parts of making the system work, because information allows sellers of goods to tell people that they've got things for sale. It allows buyers of goods to let people know that they want things. And it also allows sellers of goods to tell people about the kinds of things that they have got. Now, when you're paying for things, and we know this from our own personal experiences, but all the way up through more formalized and complex procurement processes, that money changes hands only when the buyer is satisfied that the conditions of that transaction, the things that the parties have agreed on, have actually been met. And you only know that when the information about the products or the processes or the people or whatever it happens to be actually is what you're expecting it all to be. So information's absolutely vital. Now, the trick now in terms of the digital Silk Road is to enable information to move across borders in a fast, low cost, and an accurate, dependable way. So the digitalization of information enables transactions to be sped up. It enables finance to flow quicker and smoother, because systems can be built that can automatically validate a transaction to validate that all of the terms and conditions have been met so that the funds can be released quickly. Now, that can be transformative, because once you start to look at the amount of working capital that an economic circulation system needs to keep ticking over, and you can speed that whole process up, you're starting to generate efficiencies in the use of capital itself as a medium of payment. So instead of needing, you know, $6 each year to facilitate a bunch of transactions, you can actually achieve that same amount of transactions with $5 or $4. So there's a very significant impact on economic wealth creation and efficiency simply by having smoother, more accurate, dependable information flows. And that's why the Digital Silk Road is going to lay the foundations for that next generation of efficiency and economic development. Oh,
yeah. You're listening to The Bridge.
Well, another thing that I know you're an expert in is international transactions of money, which you just touched on. Oftentimes, this is referred to as de-dollarization because it's taking away from the use of the dollar in international trade. I understand BRICS also is experimenting with some different kinds of tools for achieving trade between different countries and their own currencies. And China is already trading with several nations around the world in their own currencies. Could you touch on where we are in the state of a multipolar kind of use of currency?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think it's important just to bear in mind how money works in trading systems. And money works because it's the counterpart to the goods and services that are being transacted. So when goods and services flow in one direction, the money flows in the other direction, and they're intimately related. Money, of course, has a very interesting attribute when it fulfills that function. And that attribute is that it's only useful and valuable because it can be exchanged for other things in the future. And it only retains use and value if users can be reasonably confident that it can be exchanged for roughly the same amount of things today or in 6 months' time or in 12 months' time. Otherwise, there's no point holding on to money. So this is the inflation problem, right? So if the value of money in terms of what it can be exchanged for diminishes over time, then the incentive is to actually not use that as a medium of payment and find something else because of the asynchrony, if you will. That's, you know, the technical way of thinking about this is that when there's a division of labor, not everybody's needs are always satisfied at the same time, which means at some points in time, instead of having all of your needs satisfied, you'll actually be holding money instead. Now, you can't eat money. You can't eat money. You can't make money.
Well, you can.
And it can't be energy per se. It's only useful when it's converted into something that you can actually use. So that's the sort of foundations of it all. So something has to perform that medium of exchange function. For the best part of the past 70-odd years, the principal medium of exchange has been performed by the US dollar. Mm. And it's been able to fulfill that role because you can cycle that. So if you sell a lot of stuff and you receive a lot of US dollars in exchange, the question is what do you do with it? And you can either buy things with the US dollars or you can invest those US dollars into companies or into debentures or whatever it happens to be. But there's things you can do with it when you're holding this particular medium of exchange. But it's just a medium of exchange. And the principal usefulness of it is that you're able to use it later, sometime in the future, to exchange for things. And that you can be confident that someone else will accept it as a medium of exchange, right? So you can turn up in 6 months' time or a year's time or 2 years' time and know that you can swap it for something. Because of those properties, you don't need the US dollar for that. And there's lots of reasons why increasingly countries and businesses are looking to use something else as their medium of payment. And the main reason is a concern about whether you can swap it. That's the first one. If you become sanctioned and you can no longer use the US dollars that you hold as part of an exchange relationship, then those US dollars in effect become worthless to you. You can't swap them for something else. The fact that you hold your wealth in this particular monetary denomination exposes you to the risk that someone else can stop you participating in economic exchange. In that context, and against the backdrop of growing sanctions and other punitive measures being taken by particularly the United States, but also by the Europeans, countries around the world are starting to find other ways of exchanging goods and services with each other and denominating those exchanges. Now, we're reaching a point where I think there is a tipping point, It's not that the US dollar is unimportant. The United States is a big economy. It trades with the world. But over the last 2 years, under incredible sanctions, the Russian economy has actually managed to, in effect, wean itself off US dollars for about 90%+ of its trade already in the mere space of 2 years. This is not some little corner shop. This is a very substantial national economy. So it can happen quicker than we could ever imagine that countries can actually begin to and continue to trade with other countries without using the US dollar. We're starting to see, as you mentioned, China trading with other countries using RMB, using ruble in the case of Russia. But also accepting payment in other national currencies, whether it's the UAE dirham for oil or what have you. So we're entering into a period that probably can best be described as an era of currency multipolarity, where nations will exchange goods and services with each other, drawing on a basket of medium of payment currencies as the way that they exchange value. Now, the US dollar will continue to play a role in that, but it's unlikely that it will play the kind of role that it has played in the past 70 years going forward.
Well, I have a second question about this, because I recently was watching Economist, I think this was CNBC, and they said something like, the U.S. could never default on its debts because it could simply print more dollars and pay its treasury debts. So I thought that was really interesting, because a lot of people like to point out the fact that the United States is so heavily indebted, and that the U.S. controls a lot of the reserve currency status around the world. In your assessment, can the United States never default simply because it can just print more dollars? Or what are the consequences of not defaulting by a vehicle of just printing dollars out of nothing? Is there a consequence of that?
Well, the consequence in the end is that the value of that dollar diminishes. So at some point, the risk that you run if you keep doing this is that the exchange power equivalence of that unit of currency that you continue to print to pay the interest or the principal on your previous debts diminishes and reduces the demand for, you know, that unit of exchange. So that's one of the long-term problems. But I think that there's another dimension to this debt question in the United States, and it's not just a question of the public debt, which a lot of people focus upon, $34 trillion or thereabouts. It's actually the growth of private sector debt, household debt, and corporate debt. And I think that there is a lot more risk to the US economy in the short term as a consequence of the accumulation of household and corporate debt than there is from the government defaulting per se. As you say, you know, for the time being, the government can, of course, in a sense, print more bills to pay the lenders their interest and those sorts of things. But the real issue is actually what's going on at the household and the enterprise level. Households in the US now are paying more in interest rates for their credit card debt than they were, about the same for their credit card bills as they were paying for their residential mortgages. That's the first time in history that the amount of interest paid on those two is the same. The debts on motor vehicle loans is higher than they have been for a long, long time. Student debts, of course, are very high. Credit card debts are very, very high. Delinquency rates are high as well, at record levels. These are where the fragilities in the system are in the near term, well before we even need to worry about what's going to happen at the federal government level.
Another thing that you know quite a bit about is digital currency. And so I wanted to ask you, there are a lot of rumors circulating in media that big banks around the world are quietly buying digital currencies. Is this right? Do you think that's accurate? And if so, why?
Well, there's not a lot of digital currencies that are actually out there live in the world at the moment. There's a couple of small national projects which are already in place. China's own ERMB initiative is probably the largest by volume and by size of economy that it's related to. And so I'm not quite sure how big banks can be buying any of these things around the world. The Chinese case, I think, is an interesting one, because the ERMB, or the digital yuan, has been in active circulation now for 3+ years. And last year, it actually entered into the official money supply calculus as part of M0 within the money supply structure. And it will continue to roll out nationally within the context and the envelope of the money supply, where the addition to the total stock of RMB in the national economy will continue to grow as time goes by. And a lot of that, and increasingly more of that, will be by way of the digital version of the RMB. But I would be quite skeptical of the idea that banks around the world are buying up digital currencies at the moment, for the simple reason that there aren't actually many digital currencies out and about yet.
Hmm. Another thing concerns China's economy is the gradual transformation to what was previously called a dual circulation economy, where not only does China continue to export goods as a way to grow its economy, but also get Chinese consumers to buy products in-house. So get this huge middle class, I guess it's 400 or 500 million people now, who are able to buy products and spur spending within the economy. I've also read statistics that Chinese households are super savers and generally save around 40% of their income. So is there a disconnect between the ability of China to grow a consumer-based economy with the fact that Chinese people are generally really good at saving money? Now, I'm not an economist, so this is a legitimate question I'm trying to understand. Because on the one side, I see, okay, Chinese people are great at saving. That sounds good. But you also want Chinese people to spend their money to create a consumer economy. Can you elaborate on, is it good that Chinese people are super savers, or do we really want them to just go to the mall and watch more movies and buy more products?
There's a few things in there to unpack. The first thing is this issue of China's economic model being an export-driven economic model. In terms of its manufactures, Chinese exports as a proportion of total output actually peaked around 2004. So 20 years ago, it actually peaked and at about 18%. So 18% of all outputs, manufactured outputs, were exported then. And it's now tapered back to around 13% or thereabouts now. In other words, as the Chinese economy itself has grown, its output and production obviously grows, because that's by definition part of economic GDP growth. But the majority of that's actually absorbed by the domestic economy. So the first thing to remember is that the Chinese domestic market absorbs 85 to 95% in round numbers of the economic output from Chinese manufacturers anyway. So China hasn't actually been that export dependent for its overall economic development model for quite some time. The second thing is this issue of Chinese household consumption. The idea that gets run quite a bit is that Chinese households don't spend enough. And that means that Chinese outputs must therefore be exported instead of being sold domestically. As the previous point I made shows, Chinese households spend and they absorb, you know, the vast majority of Chinese output and output growth. So that's the first thing. In terms of actual household consumption, it's also worth bearing in mind two things. One is actually what's happening with real household incomes, because obviously, if real incomes aren't growing, you're not going to get the preconditions necessary for increased consumption. And household real income has been growing strongly for the past decade or so. So much so that over the last 12 years or thereabouts, it's doubled or thereabouts in terms of real disposable income. So households are actually wealthier today in real terms than they were, you know, 10, 12 years ago. And unsurprisingly, because of that, they're able to absorb this additional output. They also have been growing their consumption. So the relationship between how much of the household income is spent and how much of it is saved does ebb and flow a little bit. And it's certainly dropped in terms of the expenditure ratio to savings, dropped quite a bit, probably about 8 or 9 years ago, roughly speaking. But it's been picking back up quite strongly ever since. To the levels that you talked about, that sort of 60-40 level, 60 spend, 40 save. Now, those ratios are likely to, over time, continue to evolve in the direction where households will probably save proportionately less of their income and spend proportionately more. But you've got to remember, and this is the bit that I think often the sort of discourse struggles to convey, is that all of this is happening against a backdrop where the size of the pie is growing. Right? So changes in percentages isn't change of percentages around the same size pie. It's a change in the percentages around a growing pie. And that's the fact that's critical. You've got to be able to connect these two pieces, the distributional piece between whether it's saved or whether it's spent, and how much is actually available in real terms. And the real picture is that the Chinese economy has actually not been as export dependent as many people would like to suggest that it is, number one. Number two, household incomes in real terms have been growing strongly for quite some time. And number three, unsurprisingly, the proportion of that income that's spent as opposed to saved has actually been rising as well.
Well, that actually does answer a lot of questions that I had. And I, you know, you gave me a series of answers to those questions. I think I'm going to have to take time to digest them all. My next question, we're going back to energy. So China ramped up and has been ramping up year after year after year consecutively its consumption and production of solar modules, of wind onshore. So China leads in onshore, leads in offshore, leads in solar, and leads in hydropower in the world. All categories of renewable energy, China is the king. So the question is, in 2024 and 25, can we see the same levels of growth that we saw from 2022 to 2023? Is China going to keep up massive growth in these industries? What do you think?
Look, I think that there's a couple of dynamics which will drive all of this. Firstly, one is the progressive meeting of the growing needs for energy. So China's economy continues to grow at 5%+. It will continue to demand electricity and energy. That's just how economies, modern economies grow. They're, you know, you don't grow an economy without consuming energy. So you've got to create energy to be able to consume it. So that's the first thing. Economic growth will continue driving demand for new supply capacity. And increasingly, that supply capacity is going to be met by renewable technologies. Now, China does, of course, have an investment base or an install base of a lot of traditional non-renewable energy systems that will continue to play a very, very big role over the course of the next 40 to 50 years. But increasingly, the proportion of the new energy needs that will be met actually through renewables. So we're going to start continue seeing development in the renewable sector because economic growth demands it. The other thing, of course, is progressively replacing some of the rundown systems, some of the older the old engineered systems that eventually reach the end of their use-by life, their use-by date, will be replaced. So you've got to do two things. One is to meet growing needs, and the other one is to replace old equipment. So both of those will continue to drive it. The third piece, and again, this is going to be not a massive piece. You know, by volume terms, it's not small in global terms, but really as a proportion of the whole, it's not over the top, I suspect, is going to be the way that China can support the energy transformations of the developing world. Because as they developed, as they develop, they will also generate new demands for energy. Right? So to meet the energy requirements of developing economies across the global south, they're going to need new systems to generate, transmit, and to store energy. And China brings a lot of installed manufacturing capability plus know-how. And that know-how will ultimately be transferred as well, so that global South economies and communities will actually develop their own capabilities to meet their next generation of needs.
Well, I mean, I love the idea that the underdeveloped world can skip over a lot of the fossil fuel emitting processes that China and India had to go through in order to get to some degree of manufacturing in both countries. If we could do that in the underdeveloped world where they can just go straight to renewable energy, that would be great for environmentalism. But I have a second question.
And well, I was just going to say quickly that, you know, for a long time, the cost of renewable energy per unit of energy was higher than the cost of energy from long established installed traditional systems. But that has changed over the last few years, where the cost per kilowatt hour of energy generated by renewable systems is not only a match for the cost of traditional systems, but in many cases, it's actually cheaper. And when auctions have been run in many parts of the world for new energy supply without subsidies now, it's renewable systems that are winning those auctions because they're able to deliver cheaper per unit costs.
I mean, another thing I like to think about is the fact that if you're a developing nation and you install solar, great. You have now you have this solar system for 30 or 40 years before it needs to be like partially replaced. You don't need to import fuel to make that system work because fuel comes straight out of the sky. So, I mean, that's also creates more energy independence. And so I think that's a strong argument for it too. But I want to switch to the EU because you kind of go, you know, the whole world here. The European Union, I read an argument recently that the European Union should continue to allow no tariffs or low tariffs for Chinese solar, Chinese wind, Chinese onshore and offshore, because the jobs that even buying these manufactured goods and installing them still provide Europeans with jobs. So Europeans install them, Europeans maintain them. So there's an added benefit to allowing these systems into Europe beyond just the fact that they want to protect their own manufacturing base. And I heard that a better argument to trying to throw up massive tariffs on Chinese systems is to subsidize some European manufacturers at the same time as allowing Chinese green energy to come into the European Union. What are your thoughts?
These are system-related things, right? So there's a lot of moving parts. The Europe's own manufacturing capabilities, particularly around solar PVs, is actually quite modest in scale compared to the market needs. Europe itself is supplying less than 5% of its domestic requirements now through local manufacturing. But the other issues for the European Union or the Eurozone is that they're deindustrializing in large part because of the energy shocks that they've experienced over the last couple of years, together with dysfunctional supply chains that are not operating at peak efficiency levels, which means the input costs for their manufacturing sectors is actually far higher than globally competitive. One of the ways of actually bringing down their own manufacturing costs is actually making the transition to renewables and being able to do that with the least cost inputs, which is imported infrastructure from China, is actually the most sensible thing to do. So what you're looking at is essentially, you've got to be able to visualize these things as systems in motion, that what you lose on one hand, you're actually enabling other things on the other. And by enabling these lower cost inputs into manufacturing processes, it creates new opportunities for European manufacturing. And you do that in a sense by recognizing that your ability to manufacture a sufficient quantity at the right price of solar PVs, for example, is simply no match for the imported product. Ditto for the big wind turbines as well. So you've got to be able to not only look at the impacts on one particular kind of activity, but to look at how these system changes affect the dynamics of an economy as a whole. So there's actually lots of good reasons for Europe to, if it's interested in cost competitiveness in manufacturing, to move as quickly as it possibly can to low-cost renewables, as quickly as they can. And if that means importing most of the infrastructure and the manufactured, you know, goods and service, the capital goods from China, then so be it, but get on with it. The other benefit from a European point of view is that it will actually contribute towards the realization or the achievement of Europe's own objectives in terms of its carbon emission targets. Mm. So, you know, it's really about creating the next generation of employment by bringing energy costs down. It also does continue to, you know, create jobs around maintenance and things that are transferable from, you know, the old industries to the new industries. And at the same time, it addresses the environmental targets that the Europeans have set themselves. To not do that means that Europe will choose a higher cost pathway to meeting its energy needs.
Mm.
And a higher cost pathway to meeting its energy needs will mean lower living standards for households and higher input costs for enterprises, therefore reduced international competitiveness.
Wow. That's actually, you know, you should have written the article that I read because I think you did a better job of outlining it. Oh, yeah.
You're listening to The Bridge.
Okay, last question. This is a kind of question I like to ask all of my guests. So what can be done to better facilitate good economic and diplomatic relations between China, the US, Australia, Europe, mostly, you know, the most advanced countries who sometimes have quarrels among themselves. How can we maintain sustained global business growth and peace?
Being able to remain calm amongst the storm, particularly at a leadership level when there's a lot of noise and emotion around you, is actually quite important. There's lots of reasons why, for example, people in the US are anxious, at times angry, at times disappointed about where things are at. I touched on the household debt problems earlier as one of the main issues that are impacting many American households. But the fact of the matter is, over the last 25 to 30 years, possibly even going back into the late 70s, US manufacturing has been playing a smaller and smaller part in terms of employment. Overall. And that affects different types of people and different communities in different places in different ways. So whilst open trade has actually delivered a lot of benefits at an aggregate level by ensuring that the economy as a whole is able to access the cheapest goods possible, such as what we were discussing about the European situation, it does have effects on particular pockets. And unless the political elite, in the way that they formulate their policies, can address the distributional consequences of open or free trade, then inevitably there will be parts of their communities that will be adversely impacted disproportionately and without the support necessary to transition to the new opportunities through training, relocations, new industry investments, and those sorts of things. So being able to keep calm in an ocean of anger and anxiety is important. That's the first thing. The second thing is to also be able to maintain frank and open dialogue about the things that matter. So when American communities and politicians express concerns, just as they're doing out of Europe, that low-cost imports are competing and in many cases out-competing their incumbent industries and enterprises, there's a number of possible responses. One is, of course, just to ban the imports altogether. That's one. And we see that in some areas, of course. The second one is to erect tariff walls to try to, quote, level the playing field. But all that does is that it just increases the cost overall. Right? It doesn't actually make anything more efficient. It just increases the cost overall. The domestic stuff remains just as expensive as it did yesterday. And the imported stuff is now just as expensive or more expensive than the domestic stuff. In the long run, that doesn't lead to the improvement in anyone's competitiveness or an improvement in household living standards. Your third option is to somehow encourage local firms to transform and become more competitive. So we touched on the European proposition around getting your energy costs down. Now, that can be done either through direct government investment, incentives, R&D support, whatever it happens to be, industry policy, if you will. But there's no guarantees of success when you do that, because complex manufacturing in particular actually requires aligning many moving parts. And when you're trying to align many, many moving parts, there's actually high probability that you don't get the alignment right. So you'll never necessarily emulate the cost competitiveness of those that you are seeking to compete against. Your fourth option is to actually invite those companies that are actually, you know, competing very strongly against your traditional enterprises to invest in your own country. And we're seeing that in Europe with Hungary. We're seeing BYD going into Thailand, into Malaysia, into Brazil. And interestingly, Italy's actually reached out to BYD to see if BYD will consider investing in Italy as well. And interestingly, President Trump actually made a remark last week, I think it was, where he said, you know, he'd welcome, you know, BYD to set up a factory in Detroit. Now, I don't know how well that'll go down amongst sections of the American polity, but there's actually a policy sense in that, which is, hey, you've got the know-how, you've developed supply chain ecosystems that are incredibly cost competitive. I'd rather you actually do your business here in our backyard, where you can get many benefits in terms of accessing markets and convenience and all of that, than doing it somewhere else and then having to ship it all in. So if we can break out of that sense of paranoia and fear of the other, the fear of the different folk, and be open to the prospects that not every relationship is a zero-sum relationship, but that there might even be a win-win possibility somewhere in there, then there's a chance, right? There's a chance of framing policies that can begin to address the structural reasons for the anxieties in the first place. Look, there are some things which I think are very difficult, Jason, and those things actually are deep in the sort of cultural psyche of countries that have become accustomed to to entitlements economically from the world, dictating terms to others. And this goes back to the idea of the center and the periphery, right? Of those in the center being accustomed to extracting wealth and value from the peripheries. Now, all of that's changing. Now, coming to terms with that's the hard bit, and that's going to take time. And the world, in a funny kind of way, as frustrated as many people are at what I think is, you know, I'll probably call it a sort of a policy belligerence from the Americans and this strong sense of entitlement. Well, the rest of the world are actually quite patient. You know, they're sort of seeing this happen. They're not particularly fond of it. They'd rather the US didn't do it because they just want to get on with stuff. As you hear around the world, people say, we don't want to take sides. We're not interested in sides. We're not interested in sides. We don't view the world through your lens of us and them. We are who we are, and we want to be able to deal with everyone. And so the world's quite patient, I think, at the moment. We hope that through our patience that the US will find peace with itself as it makes these transitions domestically and in relation to the rest of the world. Because frankly, until the US is at peace with itself, it's not going to be at peace with the rest of the world.
You know, actually, I did notice one factory of the type that you're talking about where LONGi has entered into a joint venture with an American company. I think it's called Illuminate USA, and they've built a factory in Columbus, Ohio. So I, you know, that provides good factory jobs for Americans, solar for Americans, and it's a joint venture with a Chinese company. So I think there are all kinds of possibilities. We are at the end of our show. I want to thank you so much for your very insightful comments on the global economy, and hopefully we can have you back in the future. Professor Powell.
Thanks very much. Good to be with you again. Oh, yeah.